Hi everybody, my name is Sherry, I'm an alcoholic. I'm nervous and I'm tired. And this is one of those times where you think every judgment you've ever made is going to come back to haunt you. No, it's so true, because any time I have ever gone to a convention, if it hasn't been an American, I've thought, you're kidding. Like, I don't come here to hear the local people. Like, you know, I hear them all the time. I can go out to Abbotsford, I can go here or there, you know, so here I am. Here I am. I am so not impressed.
Flowers.
Huh?
Oh?
Anything else we can do? So it's supposed to be a spiritual breakfast meeting, so just so you know how sick you can still be. After the Friday night speaker, who was wonderful, I was in the washroom. And I could hear these women in the washroom saying, oh my God, wasn't he wonderful? He was amazing. What a good speaker. On and on and on. And I'm in this little bathroom stall thinking, what if after I talk Sunday morning, I am in the bathroom stall and I hear somebody say, you know, she was okay. You know, a bit lame. You know, I'm thinking, I obsess off and on all day about what will I do? You know, how am I going to handle that? I'm not going to be able to handle that. You know, I'm not that well. You know, I'm thinking. So then I'm thinking, what a wonderful thing Alcoholics Anonymous is, because you know how sick I have been in this program sober. Is there was a time when I would have gone to the bathroom stall, waiting and hoping that somebody, that somebody would give me a reason to vent the pain and anger that I felt inside. You know, I would create all these little scenarios, you know. I needed a reason. You know, I was so full of so much pain and so much anger and so much sadness, and I couldn't identify it, and I didn't know why. I just knew that it was there. And I could turn around in a room sober. We're talking sober, you know. It turn around in a room sober and just be raging, just be insane, just be crazy. And the remorse and the sickness and the sadness that I would feel because I didn't know why. I really, honest to God, didn't know why. So anyway, I'm going to try to stay out of the bathroom for about the first 30 minutes after the meeting. So, okay, I'll just tell a little bit about what it was like. I don't know. I mean, it's probably fairly similar to a lot of other people's stories. Raging mother. You know what? I'm mortified that this is being taped because I'm thinking, is there anybody in this room that's my enemy that knows my mom? Because I got to tell you, your karma, if my mother gets her hands on this tape. Nobody would do that. It would be a cruel thing. But there's one woman that I thought might show up here that was too bad. But anyway. I had a raging mother, an abusive stepfather, five kids, grew up dirt poor. And I've been in therapy a couple of times throughout my sobriety and came to realize in this therapy just that, you know, the damage that living in that kind of poverty had done to me. And, you know, as far as self-esteem and not fitting in and on and on and on and on, you know. So any of those signs that you see or any of those little spiritual books that say poverty builds character, that is such crap. That is such crap. It turned myself and my brother into deadly little criminals, you know. So there I was, this little dirtbag poor kid, and, you know, went to school and being abused, and it was cuckoo crazy, and trying to learn and trying to function and getting real picked on all the time. And, I mean, really mercilessly picked on, you know, and... you know, there was no safe place. There was just no safe place. I couldn't go home. That wasn't safe. I couldn't go to school. That wasn't safe. There was just no safe place. And I was a sweetheart. Like, I was a nice little kid. I know that I was a nice little kid, you know. And I remember the moment that it all kind of changed. There was these Native kids. I lived in Saskatchewan, and they had bussed these kids in to come to our school. And I looked at these kids, and I thought, they look like they're kind of poor, and they look like they kind of don't fit in. And are they ever going to get it? The bullies are going to get them. Like, oh my God, and my heart just broke for them because I thought, are they ever going to get it? Wow, lo and behold, that was not the case. These kids got off the bus, and they had been places where they had been mercilessly abused and picked on. But these kids knew how to fight. They knew how to fight. And they got off the bus, and I was terrified of everybody, and I kind of stayed away from everybody, even them. And I remember walking down the hall, and Judy Windrum one more time punched me in the back of the head. And two of these Native kids came from kind of from the corridor, and they came over to me and they said, "You know what? You need our help. She's going to kill you. You cannot allow her to do that to you. She's going to kill you. You can't allow her to do that. This is what we're going to do. When she comes down the hall the next time, you are going to get her. You're going to get her. You're going to shove her in her locker, and you're going to punch her face in. And if you can't handle it, you know, if you can't handle it, we're going to help you." And I thought, really? I'm going to do that? I can't do that, right? I can't do that. Oh, and just to back up a little bit, this bitch was my friend when nobody else was looking. Ever had one of those? Huh? She was my friend, and she would come to my house when none of the other rich kids or anybody else could see that. And then if there were other kids around, she'd do one of these. Okay? So it was pretty intense. So anyway, she comes down the hall, and they're just kind of hiding there, and they're like, get her, you know? The rage and the pain that was inside of me was unbelievable. I would have killed her if the principal had not pulled me off of her. I got her in her locker. I truly believe I'd have killed her. You know, like all this stuff you hear in the paper about these kids, I don't know, it's like, that doesn't sort of shock me, you know? I think it's tragic, and we won't kind of go off on that, but I just think, makes sense to me. So, anyway. But what happened to me at that moment was that sweet person inside of me died, because I sold out, you see. It's like the whole time, it was like I split in half. The whole time that I was pounding her, it broke my heart at the same time, because she was my friend. She was the only friend I had, even though, you know, she did that to me. So it's just to say that I was a sitting duck to pick up a drink of alcohol. And I can't remember when I had my first drink. I don't know, 12, 13, 14, 15. I don't know. But anyway, I had it. I had a drink and just started hanging around with like the bad kids. You know, they were the only kids that would really have anything to do with me. And I had been labeled, you know, emotionally disturbed, a troublemaker, you know, all those things. You know, they had labeled me all those things. So when I started to drink, and the behavior escalated, or, you know, anything to do with drinking, I was acting crazy or any of that kind of stuff, I never ever connected it to alcohol, because I had always been kind of crazy and acting out. I so related to the woman last night that was speaking about just all this acting out stuff, you know. I was lying, I'm sure, before I was walking. I mean, stealing became a way of life. I didn't quit stealing until I was almost 2 years sober. And I'm not saying that that's a good thing, and I'm not saying that I'm not recommending it, but I am saying that if you are stealing, you don't need to drink. You need never drink again if you don't want to. We don't give up that stuff overnight. And when I first got to alcoholics, I didn't know how to live. I didn't know how to live. I didn't even cross my mind to quit stealing. I mean, my daughter started kindergarten in my first year of sobriety, and I had no money, you know, and we went shopping. She was one of the best-dressed kids in all of kindergarten. I never bought a thing, you know. And the beauty of Alcoholics Anonymous, too, is, you know, like, I love, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. I love that. That saved my life. It saved my life today, you know. And I, anyway, I just remember going to my sponsor at that time and saying, you know, I've been stealing for 2 years. And she said, well, you better cut it out. You better cut it out. And I said, but if I tell everybody, I won't get to be here. She said, no, just cut it out. You know, you might get caught, you might go to jail, all that stuff. And she just said, you need to never drink again if you don't want to. So anyway, where was I now? I'm sort of lost. But anyway, I was stealing, I was lying, I was, you know, couldn't learn, thought I was stupid, knew I was stupid. That was something that I struggled with you know, and still can go there, even now, all these years later, you know, in sobriety. I don't know, just drank and started getting into trouble and wasn't a fighter, but would hang around kind of where the fights were. Got kicked out of school. I remember at one point my parents putting us, you know, putting me into this, you know, Irish Catholic girls' school, thinking that would help me. And I learned more about crime there than anywhere. I mean, I learned about crime. I mean, that's it. Put one bad kid in with all the other labeled bad kids. That was really brilliant, you know. So I don't know. I got jobs here and there, and I got married in a blackout. I got so married in a blackout. I met this guy. He had money, and see that was another thing. I thought money. If I had money, I would just be okay. If I had money, people wouldn't laugh at me, make fun of me, pick on me. If I had money. So I knew I was going to marry the guy. I mean, I did know that I was going to marry him. But the morning of the day that I was going to marry him, I got up and took a handful of Fiornal and Valium and had a couple of drinks and was going to go buy shoes to go with the dress. My sister was there with me, and she said, what are you doing? I said, well, I'm having a handful of Fiornal and Valium and a couple of drinks. And she said, but Sherry, it's like 9 o'clock in the morning. And I'm like, yeah. And so I don't know. I blacked out before we actually left the restaurant of where we were going to go buy the shoes. Came to, I think, about 4 days later. And looked at this dear man, and he was a dear man, you know, about 4 days later, and he was one of the many, many people that did everything they could to try to fix me and help me, if they only loved me, if they did, if they that, and, you know, I mean, I remember one time going and spending like $400 to get my hair analyzed, and I took, before I went there, there's a doctor out in Maple Ridge, you give him your hair, he'll analyze it and tell you everything that's wrong with it. So I took a handful of Fiornal, drank, and a handful of Valium, and away we go up to Maple Ridge, pay this guy $400 to tell me that I had zinc poisoning, you know? So away we go, and, you know, load me up with all this stuff to get the zinc out of my system, you know, it's like, but I was sick, boy. The people that were around me were way sick. Way sick. Way sick. And in there somewhere I had my daughter, who was five years old when I sobered up. And I was not a good mother. Towards the end of my drinking and eating pills, I truly, truly thought that the best thing that I could possibly do was to take her life in mine, because nobody could take care of her and love her as much as I did. And the only thing that stopped me from doing that was my friend Peg Leg, that lived in this tenement building 3 floors down from me, was not there. And I knew he was the guy that could get me the gun. He was not there. He was selling the phone when I got from the doctor and ripping me off, I found out, at 6 years sober. And I passed out. That's still a hard thing to say, you know. That is still a very, very hard thing to say. Because, you see, as a child, and before my alcoholism became full-blown, I was one of those people that would really judge. How could you do that? And why would you do that? And I also didn't want to become what I had lived. You know, I didn't want to ever become what I had hated. And I started to become what I had hated. And that's pretty hard to sober up when you've become what you hated, you know. I'll tell you, one of the things I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous is not to judge. Holy man, you know, that's a killer. That's a killer. And, but I had done that. You know, how could people do that? And they should put this one in jail, and they should put that one in jail, and all that kind of stuff. So anyway, I had this little girl, and my life, it was just insane. I mean, I could go on for hours, I won't. It was just one nightmare after another. I was always leaving, I was always moving. And that wasn't new to me. I think when I was little, I went to like 11, 12, 13 different elementary schools. My mother was crazy. She was nuts. I mean, we just would move. You know, the house was a mess, we'd move. You know, it wasn't true. You know, my stepfather would, you know, would upset her, she'd move. We just always, I'm serious, like, if the house got too fucking messy, we'd move. I mean, it was nuts. And we just always moved, and I was just always crazy. And that just carried on into, you know, all through my early 20s, you know, and all through my alcoholism. I just, yeah. Oh, also at, when I was, I think, 16 or 17, I remember trying to take my life. And it wasn't a cry for help. It wasn't to get attention. It was a carefully plotted and planned. I planned it. I mean, I spaced out when I took the pills. I had a bath. I looked fabulous. You know, I cleaned the sheets on the bed so that when they found me, and I wasn't meant to be dead because my best friend came by to get me in school. And I remember the very first thing that the psychiatrist said to me. I was in a coma, I think, for about 11 days, and the first thing that the psychiatrist said to me was, "Do you have any idea what you've done to your mother?" That was what he said. That was what he said to me. So I learned real early that you just don't talk about anything. You just don't tell anybody. Nobody cares. It doesn't matter. You don't matter. What I learned was that I didn't matter. And, so kind of nervous. Anyway, I think the very first, I had moved out to Surrey or something. I was living with some guy. I can't remember what happened, but I remember, I think I phoned the police because he wouldn't talk to me or something. I think I did. I think I phoned the police. I was afraid. And I phoned the police because he wouldn't talk to me. The police came to the house, and this one cop kind of shoved me. Turned on the lights and could see that I was drunk and wacko and everything. And he shoved me, and I remember shoving him back. And there was just this little scuffle between me and this cop. So I decide the next morning in my brilliance that I'm going to report him. So I phone the detachment of the Surrey RCMP, and I'm going to lay a charge against this guy. Well, if we ever think this isn't a police state, like, I'm going to tell you, think again. Because the next morning, like that day or the next morning or something, they were steroid monkeys. They were 8 feet tall. They were so huge. These RCMP in plain clothes come to my door and sit down, and they have a piece of paper. And they say, "Ma'am, you will sign this. You will sign this with a drawing everything that you said yesterday. And you will not lay any charges. And if you do, like, we'll make your life hell. We know where you live. And we know you're a drunk. And we know you're just a little douchebag." So, one more time, I thought, I don't have a voice, I don't count, I don't get to be here, I don't matter, you know. And I was terrified. I truly think, and I have been terrified since, the first thing I remember was fear, ever. The first feeling I ever had was fear. And I remember thinking, there was nowhere to go, there was nobody, like, I looked in this little pathetic phone book that I had. I was 28 years old, and there was nobody to phone. There was absolutely not a human being that I could call. There was nobody. I mean, I could, at that point, I could go to my mother's, who'd mellowed out. And my mother today is a woman that I love very much, who drives me crazy sometimes, I gotta tell you, but I love her very much. And I now know that she was somebody that lived with an abusive man, had 5 kids, poverty, and she truly, truly did do the best she could with what she had. And I love my mother very much today. Good stuff. If she gets hold of the tape. No, I do love my mom, and she knows that, but you know, you're going to cover your ass. So good, that's out of the way. It sort of become that I could go to my mom with my daughter, and she would take my daughter and slam the door in my face. I couldn't even go there. Like, I couldn't even go there. So I called this number. It was the only number I could find. It was a man named Jerry. You know, I wish I knew where he was. I don't know where he is, but he answered the phone, and it was called Pills Anonymous. And I had actually talked to somebody a few years prior to that about Alcoholics Anonymous, and they said to me, "You're not an alcoholic." I was a raging alcoholic. I drank all the time. They were, and I kid you not, I mean, they were in AA, and I'm serious, I'd like to find this person too. They didn't want to take me to a meeting because I was crazy and I was on all these pills. And they were kind of new to AA, and they didn't really want me to kind of go there to this meeting with them because I might reflect on them. Well, fuck them. Like, reflect on them. Are you kidding? Oh, I would recognize that person. But you know what? That person probably didn't stay sober because they were so mean. Like, oh my God. Anyway, whatever. So anyway, I called this number. It was Pills Anonymous. And this guy named Jerry answered the phone. And I lived way out in Newton somewhere. I got on a bus, and I was to meet him outside of the Hydro building, the BC Hydro building. I had said a prayer, just to back up. I just started sobbing, looking at this little phone book, saying, "Oh, geez, God, help me. God, help me." Like, I honestly got, and I was so paranoid and crazed from the alcohol and the pills, too, that I thought these police were really going to kill me. I was terrified to blow up my door. I every time I saw a police car, I was terrified. I thought they're going to run me down. They had threatened to kill me. You know, I thought, oh. And a few years before that, too, my brother had been in an altercation with the police, and he wouldn't say who the other two guys were. And these two cops up in Fredetta underneath the Portman Bridge, you know. So, I mean, and I had kind of a fear all my life of the police, because the police and social services, like as a child, anytime you saw the police or social services in our neighborhood, they were taking somebody's kids, you know, and we were always scared it would, you know, it might be us, and possibly many times it should have been us, but I just knew to fear them. And so anyway, I went to meet this guy at the BC Hydro building, and we had gotten the times mixed up. I got back and he had left a message saying, "I was there, where were you?" You know? So, anyway, my conversation with this man on the phone was the beginning of saving my life, because he, what a sweet man. And, you know, I said to him, "You know, like, you better not be trying to pick me up or anything like that." He said, "No, sweetheart." He said, "I'm gay." And, what a sweet man. I truly would love to see this man, you know. So anyway, I just would talk to him on the phone, and talk to him on the phone, and I don't know, then it kind of started. I went to some place in Richmond and went here and went there, and then I started ending up in psych wards and ending up in detoxes and never stayed. And then I went into this detox this one time, and there was this fat, mean, horrible, ugly man, Jim. And Carol knows who he is. Do you know who he is? I hated him. I hated his guts. And I was sitting out in kind of a little couch area and trying to set the place on fire. I was a fire starter. I was always trying to start fires. And I remember this one time when I was, the man that I married in the blackout, he used to come home at night and find out from the little neighbor lady across the street, Betty, what I had done and where I had gone and had I been drinking and all of that kind of stuff. And one day, crazy out of my mind, I went to her house. I said, "Betty, you ever talk to him again? Just set your house on fire." And I said, "Why do you keep telling him what I'm doing? Like, why do you do that? I don't know why you do that. Like, you're supposed to be my friend, and why do you tell him? Why do you tell him what I'm doing, you know?" And she said, "Well, I'm not doing that. I'm not doing that. I would never do that because you're crazy, and I would never do that." So sure enough, I'm spying. I'm looking out the window, and there she is talking to him. And, you know, I set her bras on fire. I did. I set her bras on fire and tried to help her put it out. Well, I was the kind of person that I still don't want to. I did. And she's wanting to tell the police and the firemen, and I'm saying, "Oh, but Betty, I still have matches." No, Betty. Mm-mm. You know? And I was the kind of person, I steal your wallet, help you look for it, you know? Sober. So, anyway, this fat mean man said to me, "You
or a drunk.
And there is help. And I'm talking about my daughter, and I'm talking about all this stuff, and he said to me,
you're not a very good mother. You're not a very good mother. Devastated me.
Because I didn't know that I wasn't a good mother.
I didn't know that.
I thought that I was. He said, you're not a good mother. He said, the best thing that you could do for yourself and your daughter and anybody that has ever or will ever know you is, you know, it's just let somebody else take care of her. And I have a wife that works in this treatment house called Aurora House. And you can go there from here. And at that time, Aurora House, it was just a little house. It was just a house. You detoxed there. You got sick there. You went cuckoo crazy there. It all just happened in this little house. You didn't kind of have to go through all this big fancy stuff that you do now. And at that time, too, the majority of people there that worked there were just members of the program. And so I went there. And I was very sick there. Very, very sick. I don't know that anything that came out of my mouth was the truth. I tried to cause a lot of trouble there. I told a lot of lies there. But I got to tell you about the ego. Like, really. Okay. I was so ill from all this alcohol and all these pills at about 10 days into the detoxing. I went into like, oh, you gotta, like, I was like, there was nothing to me. Like, I was like, I don't know how many pounds, but just, it sores all, I was just like, so gross to look at. I was so gross to look at. And I had on this black kind of nighty thing, and I'm sharing a room with this woman, Judy, and she's like, from the street, tough, tough woman, absolutely scared to death of me, wouldn't sleep if I was awake, right? So anyway, about 10 days into it, though, I go into like a grand mal seizure. I found out that's kind of what was happening. Like, I am like gone. They phone the paramedics, everything. So there I am. And at that time, I like, boys, okay. So anyway, in through the door comes this gorgeous fireman. Well, I came out of that seizure so fast. I wasn't even I'm not kidding. I'm like, oh, God, I hope I look okay. And then I almost died, you know. And Judy, when I kind of came out of this whole season, Judy looks at me and she says, oh, did you really wake up? You know? So anyway, so I did treatment there. And, you know what? No. I stayed for 10 days, 10 or 11 days, and I left. That's right, I left. And everyone that was there said, don't leave. For God's sake, don't leave. But my daughter had come to visit me and she cried. As she was leaving, she started to cry. I couldn't do it. I thought, I can't stay here. I didn't know that it was my addiction. I didn't know that it was alcoholism. All I knew was that I had to go there, and I was back there 3 months later, almost half dead. So anyway, there it began. Being an Alcoholics Anonymous and going to meetings, and there was a woman by the name of Lillian who moved to San Francisco, I think about 7 months, seven, 8 months, within the first year that I was sober anyway, that I just went to a meeting and ran into her there, and I asked if she would be my sponsor, and she said sure, and she showed up at the door of this house to take me to a meeting, and somebody there said to her, well, you can't just show up here and take somebody to a meeting. Well, I got to tell you, was I ever impressed with her. She said, really? Well, I'm here, and I'm here to take her to a meeting, and what is this house, and what do you call it, and what are you doing here with women anyway? You know? So anyway, they let her take me to this meeting, and I thought, God, maybe if I stay sober, I'll be able to talk to people like that. She didn't give a shit what anybody thought. She didn't care what anybody said. And, just a wonderful woman, and it was the very first time that I ever heard the words, you need never drink again if you don't want to. It was her that said that. She said, you need never drink again if you don't want to. And she, I just remember, one of the things I really need to stress is that Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, it's not a race here, and we're not in competition with each other. Because when I first got here, I compared myself to you, and I compared how I felt inside with how you looked outside. And if you had done your 4-step when you were 3 months sober, I thought I had to do mine. You know, if you could do, you know, all of that kind of stuff. We're not in competition. It's so not a race. You know, I mean, we're very damaged people when we get here, and to a greater or lesser degree. I mean, I might be able to do it 21 years sober, but you know what? you know, somebody can do it that I couldn't do till now, that somebody can do it 2 months, and vice versa. I mean, we're all just in different places. I just can't stress that enough, because that could have killed me. If it wasn't for this woman, Lillian, that may have killed me. Because I remember at Carol's Daily Tour, I remember I had said that I would door grade. And I got up to door grade, and I went into this panic attack, and I couldn't do it. And this woman, I won't say her name, said, "You committed to door grade. You should door grade. You said that you would door grade." I went into the kitchen. I burst into tears. I'm just sobbing. I now know I'm kicked out of AA because I can't door grade, you know? And literally, this woman that was my sponsor came in and she said, what are you bawling back here for? And I said, because so-and-so said that I had said that I would door grade. And she was kind of somebody always looking for a little bit of a fight, too, I think. Because she said, all right. She said, well, I'll go talk to her. This woman wasn't allowed to talk to me for 6 months because I already had a sponsor. She wasn't allowed to talk to me. And that's a good thing. So I, of course, being a little sicko that I was, would walk by and go, I loved it. So don't let people push you around here. You know, don't let anybody push you around. You know, we've been pushed around all our lives. I was pushed around all my life, bullied all my life. There is nothing that I will do in Alcoholics Anonymous because I'm afraid of you. Nothing. Nothing. If you try to intimidate me or guilt me or make me feel like I'm not good enough or I'm not doing enough, you best know that that's so not going to get me to do anything. What works for me is to love me. Love me. You know, want me, need me. You know what I mean? Let me know that I get to be here, that I count, that I'm important, that it matters that I'm there. Don't lay a guilt trip on me. Because I did also allow that to happen. This woman that was my sponsor very briefly moved, and I was pretty upset, you know. I mean, she was very significant in my stay here. And so I don't know, whatever. 2-3 years sober, I kind of got this... there was actually a topic yesterday about I am responsible, and I have done the sponsoring. Is my time up?
Yep.
When is my time up?
I don't know. You're always.
Okay. You know, I had kind of done this wouldn't say no to an AA request.
No.
You know, I did that. I mean, I sponsored like 18 people, and I hadn't even read Facebook yet. You know what I mean? You can sponsor a lot of people and be doing nothing, or just memorize it, tell them, you know. But it was killing me. You know, I had done all the service work, done all that stuff, and one day I was heading out the door, and my little girl looked at me and said, Mom, are you going to another meeting? And I thought, oh, my God. You know, there's this little girl. She's with babysitters all the time. You know, she had a drunken mother for the first 5 years, and now she's an AA orphan. And that was when I started to really work this program and work the steps and read what it says in here. Make sure your own house is in order. You know, and for me that means, you know, be present as a parent, and now be present as a grandparent. Be present in my relationship. You know, because I can't give away what I don't have, and I can't. I mean, it's pretty stupid to be standing there talking to somebody about their lousy parenting, you know, and my kids at home with the babysitter one more time, so I cut that out. So before you judge somebody about what they are or aren't doing in this program, maybe have a cup of coffee with them. You know, have a cup of coffee with them and ask them, rather than kind of point the finger and be thinking that they're not doing their part or doing their bit. Maybe find out why that is, you know. Because I have done that too. I have judged everybody. Oh, it was harsh. So anyway, I don't know, what can I tell you? There's one story, you know, like spiritual awakenings and spiritual experiences. You know, for me they've been, I remember being that little dirtbag kid, you know, living on that wrong side of the tracks, and my Georgie asked me to tell her story. So there was, all us kids, we'd sit on this kind of this little wood, it was this little wood steps for this whole store. And we would sit there, and we would, we were so poor, we didn't even have enough to eat half the time, didn't have shoes, you know, I mean, sad, sad story. And we would watch people. They would kind of go down, it's sort of a highway, and they would drive down this highway, and they'd be in station wagons and motorhomes, and they'd be going somewhere. And we never went any place, we never went anywhere, we never did anything.
And I just remember sitting there thinking, I mean, God, I wonder what it would be like to go someplace. Like, what would that be like to just go someplace?
And I remember picking up my daughter and her friends from school. I'm sober and I'm not stealing and I'm kind of doing the right thing here in Alcoholics Anonymous finally. And you know how if you're driving down the street and you kind of look over and you can see the reflection of your vehicle in the windows of the stores? And I'm just driving and her and her friends are in the car and I kind of look over and I realize I'm driving a brand new station wagon. And I got all these kids in the car and we're going someplace. We're going to Harrison.
And we've been to Harrison how many times? And we had been to Disneyland. And it was just like, I just pulled over. I couldn't stop crying, you know, because we were going someplace. And this little girl that thought that she was so stupid, you know, still can't spell. I cannot spell.
But they're trying to get me to be the program director of the place where I work. I make pretty good money. I think I have applied only for one job sober, and the other ones have been offered to me. Things will happen beyond your wildest dreams, you know. You can stay sober with your at anything. You absolutely can. You know, my dear friend, my dear, dear friend Barb, who had been my friend for 21 years, died of cancer on January 4th of this year. There's, you know, a fair amount of you probably know who she is. You know, stuff happens. Menopause happens. You've been straight in AA for 18 years, you fall in love with a woman, I mean, you know, that's not free. That's not free. You know? That's not, I'll say, you sure find out who your friends are in Alcoholics Anonymous. You really do. They don't want you to change. They don't. They don't, you know? I mean, I said to this one woman, I was telling her, and she immediately said, she said, so, well, I, you know, I know gay women in your building. She would, yeah. And I said, Jesus Christ, Gina, I just didn't want to kiss you. I was just telling you, you know? Whoa, wait. Oh, like, you know, don't flatter yourself. But that wasn't easy. That wasn't easy. And you know what? I have to just thank the girls from the Saturday night meeting. Really. And some of the women from Live and Let Live. Because when I started going to those meetings, they had no idea. You have no idea how hard it was to go to those meetings. Because I had was just starting to come out and coming out in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it was not easy. And but it's getting better. And Heather and Sharon, you know, my two friends that don't like anybody else, don't talk to any of the rest of them. Actually, there was a lot of people that are just so fine with it. I mean, so fine with it, but. So, I don't know, I guess that's pretty much it. I just, I don't know, my life is good. I have a wonderful job. I have a wonderful partner.
Where is she?
Oh, Jesus. Oh, they're making Georgie do that. So, I know. I really, and I have to talk about therapy just for a minute, just for a minute. Oh, I do, because I became somebody that this was my Bible. If it wasn't in here, I wouldn't do it. And, oh my goodness. And I mean, I am still somebody that thinks that, you know, a lot of the work that needs to be done in AA is being done outside of AA, and that's not a good thing, and we need to be more responsible and all that stuff. But I hit a brick wall at about 6 years sober, and I needed to go and see a therapist. That therapist saved my life. So don't be just kind of, because I had done it all. I was doing it all. I was sponsored. I was doing everything. And I woke up at about 6 years sober and wanted to be so dead. Truly. And the only thing that kept me alive is the higher power that my daughter had. So if you're at any point in your sobriety, don't be thinking that you're not working this program. If you weren't working this program, you wouldn't be in touch with those feelings. You wouldn't be in touch with feelings that were so painful that you needed to shut them down and go crazy. I mean, oh my God. Don't ever let anybody tell you that you're not working your program because of any emotion, action, or anything that you're doing. You are. We're here. We're sober. You know? Oh my God. So anyway, I had to go and see this therapist, and she saved my life. And I'm sober today because of God, Alcoholics Anonymous, and an amazing therapist by the name of Pam. And saved my life.
I would have been so dead. You know, I'm getting hyper because I'm nervous that I'm talking all those. And
I could just go for hours. Like yesterday morning, I got up and I thought, I had had a really good sleep, and I got up and I thought, take me now, boy. I am rare to God. And this morning, I got up and I thought, I am so tired. I have not slept. I won't think of anything to say, but I'm going to stop because I'm over. Thank you so much for coming.